Brian, we need to talk about resistance. If we want to build a neo-Luddite movement that can successfully resist and also avoid the same fate as the original Luddites, what should we be thinking about here?
Yeah, and that's the million-dollar question. It's a hard one.
Since the invention of the wheel, automation has both substituted and complemented labor. Machines replaced humans at some lower-paying jobs, but this was compensated by the creation of new, higher-paying jobs. In other words, tech workers. In recent years, there has been a desire from certain high-profile tech companies for an apolitical workplace. This in itself is a political act, an act designed to suppress the power of tech workers and reinforce the status quo. They know that politics is inextricable from tech, and now, so do you. Welcome to Politics.
Ray, we need to talk about season one of Politics.
I think it's really been a good one. It's kind of like an introductory season for the audience, obviously introducing ourselves, introducing a couple of guests, and introducing the subject. So I think overall, it's been a very good starting point, and I think there's a lot more to say. But in season one, we've covered the basics of AI, the tech. We've also tried to zoom out a little bit and look at the motivations and the rationale and the stories around AI, as well as, you know, the tech itself that you can easily get lost in. You know, it's like, why this AI and why now? I think that's the sort of the questions we've been trying to answer in this series. And I think we're starting to get there.
Yeah, no, I agree with that, because I think what has changed over the last 5 years, AI, as we've talked about, has been around since the 1950s. That's when the term was coined, in the late 1950s or early 1960s. I don't have the date right in front of me. But as we mentioned, it was coined originally as a marketing term, and it has been a wildly successful marketing term. It originally sparked this investment of money from the U.S. government, especially, of course, the Department of War, as it's called now. Back then, it was still euphemistically called the Department
about that, actually.
I mean, it's one of those, you know, dark jokes. We live in a dark time.
Yeah.
So AI has been around a long time as a marketing term, and there are different technologies under the umbrella. We've kind of mentioned that. We haven't really gone in depth on what those are, but obviously in the last 5 years with the release of generative AI, and especially ChatGPT, now this concept of AI is kind of front and center in the popular discourse. So that is what made us think that it's a good idea to dig a little deeper in this and examine, as you said, not only the technology, but why this, why now, basically?
Yeah. I think the thing that started to trigger us to some extent, and it was covered very well by Chris Gilliard in our episode about surveillance, is the worrying amount of data that's being collected. This is prior to this like AI hype, but it definitely helped to provide more and more data for the AI bubble that we're living in. This amount of data and the amount of processing that these systems require is quite radically different. And I think people don't understand quite how much data is being crunched, quite how much AI adds to the ecological and resource costs, to the kind of general sense of how computing is entering our life. You know, I think people obviously with the iPhone and the mobile phones in general, with the cloud systems, you know, people are seeing more and more technology in their lives. And obviously that is costing something for the planet. But this AI is something like next level. It's something else. And we've talked about it ourselves in other episodes about how all of the targets and all the ecological kind of greenwashing stuff that these companies were doing was basically just thrown in the bin. You know, and it's like, okay, we don't actually care about that. We care about inventing a god.
Right.
And obviously, the other thing we've been talking about with these narratives is that they don't really want to invent a god. They want to invent something powerful that can influence and control capital, basically. You know, so they want power and they want money and they want the ability to influence politics. And that's really what Polytex is all about.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think one of the things we looked into in the episodes about narratives and narrators is this whole narrative around inventing a god, which is kind of put front and center in this AI safety debate. You know, on one hand, you have the boomers who are like, we will invent God and it will be wonderful, you know, end of scarcity. We humans can just kick back and focus on self-actualization whilst the machine takes care of everything. And then you have the so-called doomers on the other side who are saying, we will invent a God and it will most likely destroy humanity. And this is an existential threat. You know, as we pointed to, that this is kind of a smokescreen, like, and some of these people truly believe in this, but that doesn't make it less of a smokescreen. You know, the real dangers behind this are, as you pointed to, the surveillance, the vast amount of data that's being used and misused, AI is a system of control, the environmental impact, which we haven't done a deep dive into the environmental impacts of AI, which
we
did intend to do that in season one, but we talked a lot. And I think, you know, kind toward the end of the season, you know, we realized that, like, okay, some of these thoughts that we have in our heads need a little bit more gestation before we put them out there. And definitely the environmental footprint, that is something we do want to talk about in the future. But yeah, like, these are the real threats of AI that are hidden behind this smokescreen of boom and doom, if you will.
Yeah, I think the God that's being created is what Karen Howe was calling the empires of AI.
Right.
I think her book is really important in that respect. You know, it really demonstrates the goals of these companies and the goals of the people that are behind them. The God that we're inventing is essentially a bunch of corporations. What these companies want to do is gain power, gain control. So if we're talking about a God, that's about as close as we're going to get. And I think that's an important point to understand, because we're living in a world where people are confused about facts. They're confused about reality. You know, we're in social media bubbles, and we're trying, in this series at least, and in all future series for sure, to have good faith conversations, grounded conversations with people who are critical of this technology and critical of its influence in society. We know that we can't go back to Stone Age technologies or stuff like that. And that's why we ended up talking about the Luddites, because the Luddites were a group of people that were organized and came about in the 19th century in England. They were interested in the changes in technology that were happening around weaving. And maybe you can, like, fill us in a bit, because we were reading a book together, weren't we, about this from our upcoming guest, Brian Merchant, you know, an absolute star. But it's worth pivoting to the Luddites so we can introduce Brian a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. So as you mentioned, the Luddites were a movement in early 19th century England. The height of the Luddite movement was between 1811 and 1817. And the Luddites were weavers, by and large. And what they were reacting to is the invention of these new power looms, so automation of weaving. And, you know, in popular culture, Luddite is kind of an insult, right? Anybody who is not down with the latest technological fad, you just say, ah, you're such a Luddite, you know, you can't even program your VCR or whatever. But the Luddites
were... What's a VCR, Josh?
Oh, shoot. Sorry.
You can't save to floppy disk.
Exactly. I've just outed myself as being a man of a certain age, let's say. But the Luddites, you know, we've mentioned this in passing, but they were, at the time, they were technology workers, because they were working with this latest automated technology. And weaving, this is around the time of the invention of the factory, or the introduction of the factory. Before that, weaving was very much a cottage industry, which people would, you know, they would work in their own home to weave cloth, which they would then, you know, sell in the market. So interestingly enough, some of these Luddites had these power looms in their own home and they were using them. So they were not at all against the automation technology itself. what they were reacting to is the way the technology was being used as a weapon against workers, effectively, allowing the factory owners to pay lower wages, to employ fewer people, etc. So Brian Merchant, then our guest later on this episode, so we are introducing him slowly but surely here, he wrote a book called Blood in the Machine, where he looked at this Luddite movement, which was eventually crushed by the state. And the reason he wrote this book is because there are some interesting parallels between what we're experiencing now with technology, again, being wielded in the service of these large corporations as a weapon against workers, parallels between this and the situation that the original Luddites faced.
The fusion of corporate interests and state interests can't be understated. You know, in the 19th century, the British government passed laws to the point where people became, Luddism and breaking machines became a hanging offense, a capital offense, they call it. So, you know, this is really extreme. They sent the army in to protect factories, to protect the tools and protect the equipment. So this concept of economic growth or monetary growth being more important than human thriving, there's a fundamental point, I think. And that's the fundamental point that we're trying to get to as well in this season, which is about how do we understand the purpose of AI. It's not just a technology that helps us to summarize a document. And that, I think that's the problem, is that we can get lost in the detail of small bits of assistance that it will give us and miss the bigger picture of the whole thing. And I think what Brian does in the conversation we have is, he's a great speaker and he's a great writer. And I think people will really enjoy this episode to hear what he's got to say about these comparisons and about how we may be able to resist some of these changes that are happening. It's going to take a long time. So no spoilers, but but we really enjoyed the conversation with Brian, and we think it's going to be a fitting end to season one.
Yeah, as you say, Ray, it was a great conversation with Brian, and we promise that we will actually let you listen to that conversation in about a minute. But really quickly, before we get on to that, I think we should just let everybody know that we have decided that season two is a thing that's happening. It's confirmed. And we will change our approach a little bit with season two and do a lot more interviews. So season one has been, you know, you and I talking about things.
Yeah.
And I think we have kind of said all we have to say from our perspective. And so it's really important to us to get other perspectives out there. And again, you and I are software engineers, technology workers, and I think us being in dialogue with these other people who are looking at AI from other perspectives, I think that could be really valuable to start these conversations again in our community. So that is what we have in mind for season two. With that out of the way, it is my pleasure to introduce Brian Merchant, author of Blood in the Machine, which is both a book and also a newsletter. So we'll drop that in the show notes and you all should read both of those works. So Brian, welcome to the show.
Great to meet you anyway. I mean, you know.
Yeah, nice to meet both of you as well.
Great fan of the book. And thank you for coming down to the sort of the small clubs.
Hey, the Luddites, they hatched their schemes and plans and organized in small clubs. Small clubs are where it starts. My pleasure.
So let's talk about that then, Blood in the Machine. A great book. Thank you very much for writing it. Really enjoyed it. I learned a lot about English history that I hadn't learned in school. So that was good.
I hear a good deal of that, actually, because the Luddites are taught, I guess. Like, we don't even learn about the Luddites in the United States.
No, we don't learn about them either.
Yeah. Oh, really?
But the main point is you didn't learn about, I mean, people, again, you learn about like just technology improvements and stuff like this. And you tend to learn about like just how technology just goes forward, you know. Yeah. Oh, there was the steam train, Stevenson, and then there was various other engineers, and those are the people that are lauded, essentially, you know, in history.
Yeah,
not the kind of people that contested it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I heard if you do hear about them or you do learn about them in sort of the proper history courses, and then it's you know, the typical derogatory sort of footnote. Yeah, some guys got mad, and you know, they right, smashed yeah, that which yeah. they did not understand, and yeah, anyways, progress continued, and everything was good.
Yeah,
yeah. Here in the United States, a lot of times you have to people only know it as the term if they know it at all. They only know it as somebody who, you know, wants to throw their phone in the river, or just, you know, didn't want to learn how to program their VCR back in the day, or whatever it was. Yeah, so you have to say, like, well, you're actually real people, and then this is the story of how it came about.
There's an amazing, like, throwaway joke in this old Nora Ephron movie, You've Got Mail, you know, the one I'm talking about.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There's a newspaper columnist, and some publisher is like, oh, we should talk. You should write a book. And he's like, yeah, I'm thinking something relevant for today, like the Luddite movement in 18th century England. And it's ha-ha, such a joke, you know. But apparently this is relevant, Brian. What's going on there?
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, it is funny because I think it's supposed to be, he's like, you know, coming at it from an intellectual angle, and it's like, it's supposed to be haha, but you know, he was opposed yeah. to all the, what, you know, digitalization and was doing to sort of, you know, mom and pop stores. So it was in this context. And there was, I should point out, a neo-Luddite movement in the 90s when that was, because so you'll see like Luddism and Luddite terms kind of show up sometimes in the night. It's also in Jurassic Park is one, you know, when the book came out, a lot of people, you know, okay. You know, kind of collect the pop culture references and send them to me. And so, yeah, there's a derogatory Luddite reference in Jurassic Park, and there's a few other fun ones. And in the 90s, when, you know, computerization was really sort of, you know, broadening and becoming a global, you know, economic and cultural phenomenon, there was another sort of neo-Luddite movement that's now probably most closely associated with Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, who also had some right, like more right. Broad. The neo-Luddite movement of the 90s is interesting. It's much more... It was anti-nuclear. It was very environmentally focused. It was sort of very, you know, labor was a piece of it, but I think, you know, it was much less sort of attuned to, you know, what the original Luddites were really struggling against, which is now, I think, people who are Luddites today and or sympathize with the movement are more sort of aligned to that original movement, which was largely, as we'll discuss, I'm sure, like a labor movement.
Yeah, definitely. I think the thing that I sort of like, if we fast forward to, because obviously we've got short time and we're really here to talk about like the effect of AI and stuff like this, and these are scaling LLMs. So one of the things that really hit me in terms of like reading The Blood and the Machine was this coalition of forces that were required to essentially stop the movement.
Yeah.
You know, it was basically a corrupt corporate-backed state that were prepared to hang and kill the people that were protesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it feels, I mean, I guess, you know, the horrific thing to start off this wonderful conversation is it feels like we're in a very similar situation in the US. I mean, it's a completely captured government by the tech oligarchies.
Yeah.
And he seems to be incredibly sanguine, let's say, about all kinds of human rights and very optimistic about using AI.
Yeah.
And using AI for all kinds of parts of the economy.
Yeah.
So the same playbook seems to be playing out. Well, even more aggressive, I would say, much more aggressively.
Well, it's really, I think there's a ton of parallels, and I think it's all relevant again. And I would say, and I would just, go back and note that, you know, probably the number one sort of misunderstanding of the Luddites is that they were anti-technology.
Right.
This misunderstanding that they actually hated the technology when that wasn't it at all. A lot of them used very similar technologies in their own homes. What their main protest was the way that it was being used by bosses and new factory owners to sort of organize labor and justify hiring unskilled workers and sometimes children. And so basically they were protesting the deterioration of their livelihoods, of working conditions, working standards, and the erosion of wages. And so that's the number one misunderstanding people have. The Luddites didn't hate technology. They hated the ways that bosses were using it against them. And one of the other major misunderstandings that people have is that, oh, the Luddites were just wrong. History just kind of organically sort of proved them wrong, and they were stupid to have fought against the march of progress, which is absolutely not the case. The Luddites were extremely popular, and as you said, they had to be put down by the state. You know, tens of thousands of troops had to be mobilized by the Prince Regent's office and sent into industrial districts. They had to pass a law making breaking a frame a capital offense. So Luddites could be hung if they, you know, engaged in actual Luddism. All of these different things, they had to make it easier for them to deputize and conscript local workers into sort of militias and hire mercenaries and sort of normalize defending property with, you know, guns and shooting down aggrieved workers in cold blood, basically. And then, you know, basically having the state align with the factory owners and the ownership class rather than, you know, the workers. So all of that had to happen. It wasn't just like, oh, the Luddites lost the argument. No, they were corrupt, right? You know, they were beaten down. So, like, fortunately, you know, we're not there yet. Like, we haven't had nobody's smashing data centers yet, and B, like, we don't have that level of like mobilization against aggrieved workers, and we do have some nominally democratic levers that can be pulled. But to your point about today's broader sort of social and political formation around when it comes to technology resembling that moment, yeah, there are so many distressing parallels, right? Like, you know, generative AI, for all its pros and cons, you know, in eyes of sort of technologists themselves, is predominantly being thrust upon workers by management, and it's eroding wages for a precarious class of workers, artisans, you could say, artists, translators. I just wrote about illustrators, copywriters, graphic designers. You know, these people, workers that tend to be freelance, that tend to be less well organized, that can, you know, most readily have their work sort of replaced by a corporation that's, you know, either not concerned about public blowback or that the products aren't public necessarily. And so we have these distinct sort of groups of people that are being most affected, right? And it's not as broad. Like, in again, the difference is in England, right? Like, artisans and cloth workers were like the single largest industrial work base, you know, the second only to agriculture in all of England. So today it's here and there, it's happening to, you know, creative workers, cultural workers, right? A lot of, you know, increasingly in different forms here and there, but it hasn't sort of pushed wages down sweepingly and dramatically all at once in quite the same way. And so the resistance has also been somewhat localized to it. We saw the writer's strike in the United States, the Writers Guild of America, and the SAG-AFTRA, which are the actors, the Screen Actors Guild. They both resisted AI in some pretty successful and interesting ways. But to your point about the state and the executive state and the administration, it's fascinating to see. This is an administration that is, you could accurately say, is anti-tech in almost every way except for its embrace of AI, right? Like, get rid of clean energy subsidies, get rid of electric vehicle rebates, vaccines, get rid of vaccines, you know, get rid of all these things. Oh, but here's the one thing that we will fund, that we will support, and it's AI. And I just wish everybody would think more about, like, why that is. Like, why is this the industry that he likes so much? Because they clearly, you know, see this as a useful tool from an authoritarian standpoint. It's useful for quickly creating propaganda. It's useful for, replacing or driving workers and driving down wages, as we've seen with Doge. Like, a big part of that thrust has been, oh, we have an AI first strategy in our, in our civil service now, and we can replace public servants with AI. And I realize I've kind of been monologuing now for a little bit, but that is
okay. Keep going.
Shape is similar, like sort of like the four, and I, the blunt force of the state's tactics, at least to like, to threaten people who might be in opposition to this, aren't quite there yet. But it's not unimaginable by any means. We have an occupied capital city where the National Guard from four different states has been set in on the thinnest of pretexts. So, we are at a very similar tinderbox moment. And if there is a severe economic disruption, one that ironically, may or may not be caused by an AI bubble bursting, then I do worry about what could play out, both for workers and just, civilians at large. And I would say that the other reason Ray was right to point this out is the diminishing sort of quality and stature of democratic mechanisms that we can pull. So that was maybe the biggest one in the Luddite's day, right? Britain was not yet a functional democracy by any stretch of the imagination, really. So there's no one to petition, even though they did petition. There was there were no elected officials that could be penalized for not voting with the workers. It was still, very, very much top down. And it was very hard to get anything, substantive through. And you also had this, I think, that historians have described as like ferociously conservative parliament at the time. That was the House of Lords was just kind of thunderously laissez-faire, or at least a faction was the powerful enough to sort of, the pro Adam Smith faction, was so strong that they were able to sort of push back any form of popular sentiment, even though it was clearly there. Most people wanted labor protections. They wanted the industrialists to be penalized for tearing up the old, social contract and breaking the law. And a lot of times there were laws about apprentices and thread count and all these things that the industrialists, just like, OpenAI or Uber today, have said, oh, that doesn't apply to us, right? Like, that doesn't apply to us. We're a technology company now. This is the future. And they're saying, well, that's the old times. Now we have these, new industrial factories. We don't have to, do things like, make sure that there's, enough work to go around, or it's of a certain standard. That's old time stuff. Mm-hmm. But suffice to say, like, it was, and unionizing was also, illegal. The Combination Act had underscored that point. It was illegal to form a combination or a union and to collectively bargain for your rights. So they, the Luddites were not able to, organize peacefully by law. So
right.
Today, we do nominally have that ability, but you also look at the reality on the ground in the United States, and union density is the lowest it's been in half a century. And so effectively, it's very difficult to oppose this through organizing. We just saw with Trump and his AI action plan that he released, that the whole, he's taking sort of Vance, J.D. Vance, who is a product of the Silicon Valley VC ecosystem and is shaped his
friend of the show,
right? Friend of the show, J.D. Vance. and he's kind of, allowed basically the most, right-leaning, anti-regulation teal-esque characters to sort of shape AI policy. That means it's a call to sort of do away with any regulation. They tried, but very narrowly failed in the United States, to pass a law that would prevent the states from making legislation around AI. So you don't get much more profoundly anti-democratic than that. So you have these two. So you have a big automation technology embraced by the state, embraced by the corporate and ownership class, and you have just percolating anti-democratic tendencies that are, you know, enshrined in many contexts. On the federal level, nothing's going to happen in terms of AI regulation or policy in any meaningful capacity in the next 3 years. On the states, maybe we'll get some. As we're recording this, Colorado, which is the state that passed the first sort of meaningful, you know, AI legislation in the U.S. this year, has now had seen a special election called explicitly on the behalf of the interests of big tech to basically have it watered down, if not sanded away altogether. And this is some pretty, you know, and I wouldn't call it toothless, but it's not like super offensive. It's just, it's calling for transparency in the data sets and restrictions on like workplace use of opaque algorithms. So it's just saying like, if you're using AI in these contexts, you have to do this. And California has some bills coming down the pike too. We'll see what happens with that. But they wanted to snuff this out, and now the industry is mobilizing to do that. So to your point, yes, we have both of these features, especially in the US, and you know, the UK,
oh my God,
isn't much better. You have an AI loving labor party that's going all out to do the industry's bidding there too, and we're seeing it everywhere. It's really this, it is this assault on what people in the streets and in the workplaces are saying. Like poll after poll after poll in the U.S. says that people are more concerned excited about AI. In California, they just did a big in-depth survey, 70%. They want regulations. They want democratic control over AI. And the industry's power, influence, and, you know, just horde of capital they're getting and throw at, you know, various campaign finance departments is enough to override that. It's just remarkable what we're seeing, the disparity between, you know, what people actually want with regards to this technology and governing it, and what's playing out in governments, not, you know, maybe most dramatically in the US, but also in a number of nations around the world.
Yeah, I think the regulations that people are talking about are pretty basic. Like you say, they're kind of like, well, you know, let's make sure that there isn't like child pornography in the data model.
Yeah.
Let's make sure that, you know, if you're using it in like life or death decision making or critical infrastructure, then, you know, you shouldn't be using it there. And it's, yeah, it's quite tricky to say that, well, on its face, that seems like a very simple argument to defend.
Right.
But it feels like, for whatever reason, well, we know the reasons, but let's enumerate them in more detail. You know, that they don't want these regulations. They don't want to be touched by them. And again, the reason for that is because they just want to take more and more power, more and more resources.
Yeah.
The thing that's really weird to me is that they're arguing a lot of the times, well, the technology is changing so rapidly that these politicians are so dumb, so you can't regulate a very fast-moving, innovative industry. It's too early. It's too early. They always say this.
Yeah.
How do you respond to that, Brian, actually? Because this is always, I mean, I've heard a lot about this, but I've got a lot of opinions, but I'm very interested in your opinions.
Yeah. I mean, this is the default position in the United States, not just of, you know, Republicans, but of Democrats. In fact, there was this interesting period where, and to some extent, we're kind of still in it. You can get some Democrats to care a little bit about like the labor impacts, and, you know, most of the stuff that's proposed on the state level is looking at that, you know, like, you know, workplace surveillance or hiring and firing algorithms. But by and large, like any serious intervention has been. Historically, for the last two decades or so, just off the table, right? Like this is, it's been also instrumental in, you know, allowing Silicon Valley to accumulate the power that it has today. Is that, you know, not, it was Obama who really sort of ushered in a lot of the hype and enthusiasm around sort of Silicon Valley as a, you know, a engine for progress, right? And it's been hard to sort of get people to it's broken down a little bit over the last 5 years or so with various scandals mounting in every major tech company, just about starting with probably Cambridge Analytica back with Facebook and the election of Donald Trump the first time, and this sort of misinformation sort of machine, and that kind of became maybe one of the first sort of sources of blowback. And again, you can get some people concerned about that, the more sort of, I guess, moral panicky side of tech products, you might characterize them. And so there you'll get a little bit of criticality around, you know, what we should be showing to children or things like that. But in terms of really drilling down and saying, you know, should we be giving these companies this much power to, you know, do nothing short of sort of rewrite the social contract when it comes to labor, especially with gig work and Uber and Lyft and Amazon really sort of spearheading this effort to destabilize a lot of the already lacking sort of New Deal era protections that workers had, and said, well, we're going to turn vast swaths of the workforce into contract laborers. And there was that effort really began and was encouraged by Obama. And it really has made it difficult to have any sort of political, or at least sort of party level political resistance, take shape or sink in, because it was out there. Like Obama, a lot of people who were my age or older, you know, Gen X people and early millennials, like Obama was like the last time that people felt good about politics, that the country was headed in the right direction, and, you know, we're breaking down racial barriers, and, you know, the economy's is doing okay, at least until the crash. And then now, you know, it's taken years of controversy, years of these tech titans and the sort of Silicon Valley companies that have grown, you know, historically more powerful and more wealthy than nearly any other companies or industry on the planet, for people to say like, well, maybe that's a bad idea. But even now, despite all that, even after Trump's elected, you still have Democratic congressman like Ro Khanna, who's
California.
Silicon Valley is in his district, kind of, you know, saying like, oh, you know what? We should have been nicer to Elon Musk. We shouldn't have alienated him. That was the Democrats' mistake, was to, you know, alienate Elon Musk instead of, you know, being nice to him and making sure we were on the side. So it is this enormous problem that is still in the process of sort of collapsing, this idea that technology is inherently the engine of progress. It's uniquely American. You know, there's much more capacity, I think, to be critical of Silicon Valley, you know, when you're on the other end of its products, you know, and there's a reason like Canada and Australia have had some of the strongest sort of anti-Europe, you know, have had some of the strongest sort of laws pushing back against Silicon Valley. But yeah, you can't regulate progress. It's just coded into sort of the mindset of a lot of more the Democratic Party and, you know, and Republicans, which are, you know, sort of de facto pro deregulation on every count. So as long as the Silicon Valley companies are backing them, then, you know, they'll, you know, therefore deregulation. I started this particular long-winded rant by gesturing towards the fact there was this period where, you know, Silicon Valley was most under fire from the right because of these, you know, sort of ironically trumped up, you know, assertions that they were censoring conservatives, which is like, of all the things that they were doing, that's like the one thing that they really, I mean, everybody's conservative uncle got boosted ad nauseum on Facebook. We all had to see those posts. Like, there was no censoring of conservatives really in any capacity. They just found it advantageous to sort of push this narrative because they saw Silicon Valley at the time as being aligned with Obama and being these bastions of Democratic power. And so they have pretty successfully pulled the Silicon Valley apparatus, you know, out of the Democratic Party's reach and into sort of their own. And that's why we have this very sort of Peter Thielian sort of epoch of, you know, holding sway in Silicon Valley right now, where it's, you know, all about expansion and power and transactionalism. And, you know, you barely hear any of the sort of early Google-esque don't be evil or Steve Jobs.
Right.
It's a joke now, literally, isn't it?
It's a joke now. Yeah, it really, really is. And so, yeah, so part of the political project, I think, of this moment is capturing that animosity, because it's, again, it's party level. Like, party leaders still see Silicon Valley as a potential source of money and exposure through their platforms. Working class people, the middle classes, in general, sentiment towards Silicon Valley is quite low.
Brian, we need to talk about resistance. If we want to build a neo-Luddite movement that can successfully resist and also avoid the same fate as the original Luddites, what should we be thinking about here?
Yeah, and that's the million-dollar question. It's a hard one. There is a very potentially popular political project in sort of, it's tapping into that widespread animosity. It is getting back to the business of organizing. It's finding ways to sort of do so, you know, off of the platforms themselves, which, you know, I think even a lot of people on the left at least found the platforms interesting in terms of the potential that they posed for reach and things like that. But it's been borne out that it's just, they're too, you know, beholden to their owners and operators, and they're out, you know, it's easy to deboost certain posts. And we've seen it on X, what's happened. It's just like, you know, now it's just this pay to play platform where Musk and his followers get boosted, and all the algorithmic juice is given to a certain cohort. And so that, you know, we have to find new ways of actually sort of getting in the trenches and organizing, and it can be done. Like, I've seen it happen successfully on a small scale. You know, I covered the SAG and WGA approach. I've covered a lot of lower visibility, you know, union activity, and the anger, the resentment, the thirst for change is there. It's just a matter of finding a way to overcome these huge stores of influence and power and capital that the companies have and can unleash on you at any moment.
Yeah. And I think that's what we're trying to do, you know, with this whole project really is. I mean, Ray and I are programmers, tech workers, and there is, luckily, outside of Silicon Valley, over here in Europe, there are a lot of tech workers who are also pretty disgusted with Silicon Valley, which is great to see.
Yeah.
We know a lot of people who are not just lapping up the LLM coding tools and all of this. It's interesting because, you know, going back to the Luddites, they were also tech workers, right? They were working with technology of their day.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the difference between Luddites and programmers, or the OG Luddites and programmers, are the Luddites, as far as I know, were not the ones building the, you know, the automation themselves, right? So that's, to me, we programmers are actually building the stuff. And I feel like that gives us some kind of unique power to actually stop it, right? And so that's kind of what we're trying to get at here.
I do think that that's like a really key piece of it, if, you know, and it's also an interesting potential sort of front for change here, even here in the United States, because, you know, for a long time, the lavish sort of salaries and benefits promised to tech workers, to American tech workers, kind of served as both it obfuscated a lot of the harms that the companies were doing by the works, and they said, and it sort of incentivized a lot of, you know, workers to want to join that cohort, even if they weren't there. They said, making noise will prevent me from getting one of these plum jobs. So it was very, I think it had a pacifying effect for a long time. But now we're seeing a heel turn in a lot of these companies, with a few exceptions, where there's mass layoffs, there's increased reliance on contract workers. You know, famously, Google is almost like half contract labor now. And that, you know, dream of having these, you know, these plush jobs is, you know, both materially and kind of psychically being eroded. And so I wonder if that will leave more dissatisfied tech workers who are willing to sort of take things on. There have been a lot of great efforts and great tech workers who have done a lot to try to mobilize their employees, like especially at Amazon and at Google and Microsoft. And they have been limited quite, you know, severely by those forces and the company's kind of tactics. And it hasn't really yielded the results that a lot of folks have had. We, you know, there's the Alphabet Workers Union, there's the Amazon Employees for Climate Justice. There are these orgs doing good things, but they haven't been able to mobilize the sort of degree of change that would be necessary. And I do wonder if, like, this new attitude now where at Google, it's just, oh, you're gonna, you know, protest Palestine, you're fired. Like, you're done. It's not like, let's have a discussion with you. Like, it's like the gloves are off now, and they're just starting to look more again like you're the old school sort of monopolists. They're going to start looking just like worker squeezing.
You know, yeah, called the Pinkertons.
Called the Pinkertons, or you know the Robert. If not that, then just sort of, you know, like now they're General Electric or something that people aren't super excited to work for. You can still get a decent paycheck, but maybe you don't feel, you know, any special affinity for, or you're pissed off that they just, you know, fired your friend for, you know, for doing a sit-in. So I think that there is a lot of capacity for change, both at the major companies and others, as tech workers increasingly sort of have more solidarity with workers who've been struggling for a longer period of time. So that's, you know, that's another front. And I do think that, you know, even just for purely ethical reasons, I hope that it becomes clear that the project of a lot of these tech companies now and the bigger ones are explicitly to sort of sell government contracts to the Trump administration.
Yeah.
To help with, you know, it's not just Palantir anymore. It's OpenAI and, you know, and Anthropic even. And so I do think that this change, I hope, will, you know, facilitate the ease with which organizing can be, which has been historically very difficult at these tech companies, not just for the reasons I listed, but also because, like, culturally it was, you know, supposed to, you know, it wasn't, labor organizing was very much not of the sort of the cultural DNA of Silicon Valley. So it really kind of envisioned itself from the beginning as something, you know, countercultural and sort of, you know, unions were kind of the man. And like, this is all very like a hippie-ish, yet also grafted onto the military industrial complex-esque project. So hopefully that's changing too, and we can see it more as like a surface where organizing can happen. And, you know, it's just like everywhere else in the United States with a Trump friendly National Labor Relations Board and very few protections for a lot of workers. It's still risky, but, you know, maybe maybe the risks are worth it to more people.
Yeah, I was going to say maybe, I don't know if this is a resistance question, but it's a kind of like definitely an interesting question. Something that we've been exploring a little bit is the move up from a kind of competitive marketplace to a kind of global war, if you like, between America, Europe, and especially China. You know, as soon as like the DeepSeek models kind of hit the streets, you know, earlier this year, all the stock prices went through the floor. You know, that was a good thing to see.
Yeah, for 5 minutes. Yeah.
For a little bit of time where NVIDIA went through the floor and...
A little bit of a...
Pardon me?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I was just saying it happened again a little bit after the, you know, GPT-5 launch kind of was...
Yeah, right. It was a disappointment, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, people maybe are beginning... This is the thing we were going to talk about. There's two parts to this. I know we kind of want to wrap it up in a minute, but like there's... I would like to take a little bit of a diversion to the global scene, just to see if other countries could potentially be the axis of resistance.
Yeah.
And then maybe we can like finally talk a bit about the fact that maybe AI has some uses, but maybe it's reached some of the limits of its capabilities, and all of this other like nonsense about like continue to invest and burn the planet down, maybe this isn't a good idea.
Yeah. To the first
point.
What
a leading question.
Yeah. Well, hey, maybe, you know, I'm just, this is
my kind of leading question. Yeah. I think it's really encouraging to see sort of this digital sovereignty kind of movement start to take shape, and the anti-US tech movement, which my friend and fellow traveler Paris Marx has been sort of advocating on his platforms. I would encourage, he's got a great guide to ditching US tech on Disconnect that is worth checking out. You know, I think Brazil has been interesting. It's been a good thorn in the side of Trump in some ways, and of the sort of the orthodoxy that it's trying to, that the US is trying to impose on sort of accepting the US's and its tech industry's sort of way or the highway, and Brazil's kind of saying no. And is, you know, I think that we need to see more of that, threatening to say like, no, if you don't change this policy, we'll shut you down, right? We're not gonna sit here and like, you know, and fine you, or you know, you pay these minuscule fines that you can afford.
All right,
we will just make your service unavailable. And then when you have a country as big as Brazil that's talking like that, you know, yet you stand to see some real change. And unfortunately, like Canada, after, you know, its new prime minister kind of, you know, rose to power, making all this anti-Trump, anti-Silicon Valley noise, has just kind of put his elbows back down and is negotiating again with the industry. But, you know, the journalism acts that Canada and Australia have, where it's like, you, Google, and you, Facebook, are parasitic operations that are making use of the news and the content that is published for free on your platform. And then you're selling ads against it. You're taking revenue away from publishers and media and journalists. And so we're just going to make you pay a tax for that. And it's, again, perfectly reasonable, hard to facilitate, but perfectly reasonable in principle to say, hey, you have gutted our journalism industry. We don't want to see it die. Here, we're going to claw back some of that value at a fair rate, and you can be involved at the table. Like laws like that, that actually say, we recognize the social value of what you're extracting from us and profiting off of. And we are going to, you know, we're going to pass laws or fight against it. More in the streets, there's a lot of, I guess, there are groups, you know, in all across Europe that are, you know, that I hear from regularly, that are taking a more Luddite stance, more aggressive, are ready to be more aggressive. There's a decompute movement that's begun. It's still quite small, but, you know, Dan McKillen is a smart guy, and he, you guys might want to have him on too sometime. But there are folks interested in this stuff. There is some growing momentum. It is still, I think, quite atomized, with the exception of a few major actors that I think, you know, should be lauded, and sort of organizers should point to the successes that you know, a state like Brazil has had, or the, you know, the money that comes in when Australia actually rolls up its sleeves and takes on Silicon Valley to save its media industry. And so, yeah, I do to your second question, I think that we may, you know, you never know, but we may be entering a period where, despite its sort of mass sort of concentration of power and capital, Silicon Valley may be at a unique point of vulnerability as the AI bubble, you know, either deflates or bursts or just generally looks more brittle as the promises made fail to deliver. So there may be a point of weakness there as well for more folks to point to agitate against and to organize. And that's what we can end maybe by saying, just reminding folks that, like, this is popular, right? Yeah. It is popular to stand up to big tech, to say like, this use of AI sucks. Like, why don't we just, like, you know, why do we have to be like litigating how AI, like, what's the best way to get AI into my sixth grader's classroom? Like, maybe it's not. Maybe we don't, right? Maybe, and yeah, a lot yeah. parents and teachers and even administrators sometimes will stand up and applaud if you do that, if you have the guts to do that. And so recognizing that there is this sort of latent, not just anxiety, but sometimes anger against AI in its current form.
Right.
Because you're right. As you said, like you can say like, well, it has these select use cases and it's good for this and it's good for that. And that's true. But we have a very kind of discrete social and political formation that has taken shape around AI. And that is, AI is a very specific entity right now. It is the AI that is being used to automate jobs. It's the AI that is being used by the Trump administration to justify clearing house at key public agencies. It's the AI that is creating political propaganda that's posted to the White House Twitter feed. And let's, you know, we can't just say, oh, well, Silicon Valley is different. No. Silicon Valley and its leadership have taken regular meetings with the president. They've gone to Mar-a-Lago. They stood and clapped behind him when he was inaugurated. OpenAI has contracts with the federal government where it's getting ChatGPT into federal offices. It's quite a tight formation. Silicon Valley lobbied for this effort to get a ban on legislation passed against it. It was immensely involved in that, specifically Google, Meta, and OpenAI. You know, there were other factors. Oracle was in there too, but others. They all are on the same page, and they are deploying generative AI for a shared purpose, I would argue. And so in that sense, I think, yeah, you can say, oh, well, like, you know, LLMs are actually quite interesting to discover new protein. It's like, okay, well, so let's let the universities do that, right? Let's not let Silicon Valley do that, okay? And so I think just say, I think having confidence to say, like, we can be against AI in its current form. We can resist generative AI, right? We can say generative AI is a corrosive force. If it does anything, it's going to be a detriment to education, to labor, to the youth, to vulnerable minds, to politics. Yeah, deepfakes. You name it. And I think on those grounds, we can say, you know what? I'm comfortable in saying I think this is a corrosive force to society, and we can just fight against that. There may come a day where we can say, like, let's. I mean, we absolutely should be pushing for other things too, like more public compute, so that public institutions can access the compute that they need to make, you know, actual AI that might be interesting to researchers.
Yeah, and a decent basis for it. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, a decent basis for it. Because again, it isn't that like the technology itself is inherently terrible. It's just that it's being developed and controlled and used by a specific set of actors.
Exactly.
Well, with that, Brian, we had better thank you for your time and send you on your way, hammer in hand, I'm sure.
always. You can maybe see it leaned against the wall in the back behind the chair. I have it. And it's never far. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for this conversation. I'm thrilled to join you. I support this project very much. And yeah, best of luck to both of you. Cheers.
Wonderful.
Thanks, Brian.
This is that bit at the end where we thank you for listening to this episode of Polytex. First, we hope you enjoyed the show, and we really appreciate the time you have given to this subject. If you want to follow up with us, please send email to podcast@polytex.dev, because that's very direct and doesn't have any algorithms. If you prefer social media, we're at Polytex on Blue Sky and at Polytex at mastodon.social. We're not on Twitter for obvious reasons. To help the show reach a wider audience, please share it with your friends, family, and colleagues. There's nothing as good as a real human recommendation. You can find out more about the show on the website, which is polytex.dev. As you should expect, there are no cookies or tracking of any kind. All the show notes, transcripts, and contact details are over there. If you want to show a deeper level of commitment, there's also an option to donate. We're passionate about free and open access to the episodes, so there's no obligation and there are no benefits other than a warm feeling in your heart. Finally, we would really appreciate a 5-star review on your podcast platform. Reading positive reviews makes us feel good and can help others find the shore and make them feel like it's worth their time. Okay, that's all the admin done, and we hope to see you next week. Bye!